The Navigators is an international, interdenominational Christian organization whose objective is to help fulfill Christ's commission to make disciples of all nations. They individually teach the basics of the Christian life to new believers, who then teach others. They work on campuses, military bases, and among lay men and women on every continent.
We're going to talk about the realm of the relationship between yourself and your children from the cradle until they leave home, which hopefully is on marriage or on their own. Not that they're married and then they leave home a few years after that. That usually isn't the best thing. So what we'd like to do first is to give you three scriptures that relate to this whole thing. The first one is our hope as parents. And that's 3 John 4, which says, I have no greater joy than to hear that my children walk in truth. That's our hope. The second has to do with God's promise. In Proverbs 22:6, train up a child in the way he should go, and when he's old, he will not depart from him. And the third has to do with our responsibility. Proverbs 27:23 says, know well the condition of your flocks. Give yourself to their needs. And I think if we can keep those scriptures in mind in relationship to our children, it'll really help us as we have the responsibility and privilege of being parents. What we'd like to do is to share some suggestions to help you in encouraging your children to grow in maturity, spiritually, socially, physically, mentally, emotionally, that they will be well-rounded individuals. These principles are applicable to them from the time they first start understanding what you're saying, all through the years that you have a responsibility for them, even though they may have to be adapted for the age levels. Now, the first has to do with a child's self-image. And honey, would you share on this?
Again, we're not going to be dealing so much in the specifics, but in concept. And though we could take some time on developing a child's spiritual growth, our purpose is to help you see the needs of their emotions and what will end up in that finished product as a youngster who can be independently dependent upon God himself. I've been impressed with Luke 12:48 recently, that everyone to whom much is given of him shall be much required, and to whom men have committed much of him they will ask the more. And I've always thought of that verse on a relationship with people. That if I commit something in our marriage, for example, I've committed myself to Elvin. And so I expect a lot from him. And he's committed himself to me, and he expects a lot from me. But I'd never thought of that verse in relation to my walk with God before. That my responsibility, my joy, my privilege has been to give to God all that I am, just as I am, and ask him to take me and then make of me and remold me from within. Well, you know, there's a book called Why I'm Afraid to Tell You Who I Am. And in sharing the title, the author gave that to a friend one time, and the friend said, would you like me to tell you why? And he said, well, the reason I'm afraid to tell you is because if you don't like me, that's all there is. There's me. But I give myself to God, and then I can commit that to him, and then my requirements of God are pretty big. And I've been asking God that I might learn in our life, in my personal life, in our marriage life, and in the children's life, to ask big. And that's what I want for our children, is that they would be independently dependent upon the living God. And the first principle we'd like to share with you is that of encourage your child. Now, we've talked to enough people to know that when you tell a child that he's okay just like he is, He doesn't have to perform to be approved. If you do that, mommy won't like you. It's devastating to a youngster. And by encouraging them, we create a desire in the child to do better. We build self-esteem. And a child's attitude toward himself are formed by the image he gets of himself in his home. It's interesting that a child will see himself as his parent sees him or as he thinks they see him. If they're coming across in one way, he tends to see himself that way. And fathers might especially take note of this. Fathers need to spend that time encouraging their youngsters also. Somehow mothers seem to have a built-in encourager that starts in when they get up in the morning and by and large can go through the day. Dads need to take the time to encourage their kids. One of the sweet examples of a father relationship and encouragement, the kind of a relationship they had, is Abraham and Isaac back in Genesis 22 when God had told Abraham to take Isaac up and to offer him. And here they go, trudging up the mountain, and on the third day, Abraham sees the place where they're to go. He's going to offer his son. And he said to the young men, "You stay here. We'll go on ahead, the boy and I, and then we'll come to you again." And Abraham takes the wood, and Isaac carries it up. That figures Dad's getting up a little bit. And he takes in his hand the fire and the knife. And they went on together. And you get the feeling that these two had walked together before. And Isaac said to his father, "Abraham, my father." And he said to him, "Here am I, son. Here am I, my son." And he said, "Behold the fire and the wood, but where's the lamb for a burnt offering?" And Abraham said, "God will provide himself the lamb for a burnt offering, my son." And then you know the story and how God did not ask Abraham to give his son, but tested his heart. But the relationship of that father and son showed a mutual encouraging kind of a thing. And God does this for us. Actually, a child's social class or ethnic background have little to do with his picture of himself. He gets most of it from within the home. His relationship to the world around, he will pick up from his parents. By and large, there are other input, but that's a strong one. Now, God does this with us, does he not? In Romans, it's, "May the God of steadfastness and encouragement grant you to live in such harmony with one another in accord with Jesus Christ, that together, with one voice, you can glorify God and the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ." He's the God of steadfastness and the God of encouragement, and our kids need that. And Proverbs 16:24 said, "Pleasant words are like a honeycomb, sweetness to the soul and health to the bones." If you want healthy kids, pour in encouraging words. Now, if they don't, our children have a tendency to become fearful and timid, afraid to move out. Or they can go the extreme of bullying and bragging to get attention, unable to make decisions because they don't know whether they're approved in what they do. And there can be an expectation of failure. And you encourage at all age levels. You encourage by words, but you encourage by touch. One of the ways to encourage in a practical way is to know what your children are doing, their schedules, what they're involved in, so you can offer encouragement. Be interested and follow them. As Elvin has said, know the state of your flocks. Where are they? Are they in a tough place right now? And wives, we can really be a great help to our husbands here to give them input into where the kids are. And have you not had this experience of you say to your husband, "You know, Linda's down a little bit." "Down a little bit? I didn't know she was down." Yeah, somebody asked her the other day, she's 25, somebody asked her, "Hey, aren't you married yet? What's wrong with you?" And Dad, she needs, that hurt. And husbands may not know some of these details that we pick up. So we can be a great asset to our husbands in giving encouragement to the children.
Another great area of need is for us to spend time with our children. Time just for them. Children don't need gifts as much as they need us. Several years ago, when I was back in business, our daughters were just getting ready to start school. I had to travel quite a bit. In fact, I was on the road about half the time. And we made a kind of a practice that whenever I'd go someplace that I'd try to bring each member of the family a small gift. And getting pretty tough. I was out of town almost every week. And I just about decided I was going to cut the practice anyhow because it was getting so expensive. But I came home this one time, and almost always when I'd hardly get in the door before the one of the girls would say, "Hey, Dad, what'd you bring us?" Or they'd want to get in the suitcase and see what was there. But this particular time, they didn't say anything. They didn't grab the suitcase. They didn't ask me about anything. They just stayed with me. And finally, I said, "Well, hey, don't you want to know what I got you?" I forget which one of them said, "Daddy, we appreciate the gifts you give us, but really, what we want is you." Well, you know, Dad's old heart really responded to that one. But, you know, people who are around their kids all the time, they don't have to travel, can still be gone from their children. You don't have to be on a trip to be isolated from them. You can be wrapped up in the paper or television set or your own thing, whatever it may be. Or you can be with them, but doing your thing and not their thing. Or you can be in them with their thing, but your mind's 1,000 miles away on something else. And they pick that up before long. You know, they talk to you and say something while you're together, and you say, "What was that you said?" And they soon pick up the fact that you're not with them. And your children want you. They don't. They appreciate the gift, but really it's you that they want. And often we find that children who have an abundance react in the way that they feel cheated because they had things but not their parents. The story is told of a judge who was presiding over a case of the son of a very well-known man. And the judge said to this young man, he said, "You know, what surprises me about this is, you know, your father is such a fine, respected, well-thought-of man." The son said, "I presume that's probably true. I really wouldn't know because he never spends enough time with me to let me know for sure." Or it's perhaps described in a little poem here that by Joy Allison. It says, "I love you, Johnny," said mother one day. "I love you more than I can say." Then she answered his questions with, "Don't bother me now," and just didn't have time to show him how to tie his truck to his tractor and plow. But she washed her windows and scrubbed the floor and baked and cooked and cleaned some more. "Bring the neighbor in." "Well, I should say not. You'll truck up my floors. I don't want a spot." "No, we won't have time for a story today. Mother's cooking for company, so run out and play." "Maybe tomorrow," she said with a sigh. And Johnny went out, almost ready to cry. "I love you, Johnny," she said as she washed his face and sent him to bed. Now, how do you think that Johnny guessed whether it was he or the house that she really love best? You know, we can and should provide the material things for our children. But we could provide everything possible for that, for them. And if we don't give them ourselves, we've robbed them. But if we give them ourselves and we don't give them anything else, we've given them one of the most priceless possessions the world has to offer. So in spending time with your children, give yourself to them. And in the things that they want to do on their terms. You know, I don't always go out at my age and my stamina of life. I don't always like to go out when I come home from the day and I'm going out in the evening and go out in the backyard and wrestle around with Lance or whatever. Now, I do enjoy shooting baskets with him. But and knocking him grounders, things like that. But sometimes he wants to do other things. I don't particularly enjoy that. And even sometimes in the pressure of time, I don't even like to do those things. But, you know, he needs that desperately. He's like an only child. He doesn't have siblings to play with. So Dad has to come in. And, you know, it's not always easy. But I tell you, it's worth it. Often, I try to get him ready for bed before I go. I'm the one who bathes him. And I may be going out for a Bible study. And so I clean up before the evening and take a bath. So he and I take a bath together. And, you know, that's one of our best times together. We'll sit there in the tub and he'll say, "Hey, Daddy, Tell me more about Jesus. Yeah. What do I want him to ask me? Isn't that it? Sure. And we just kind of have a love-in together there, Lance and me. But we have to give time to him. It's important to remember that when children are little, that they need a lot of short times. You know, they don't want, their interest span is such, they don't need long times with you, but they need you to give yourselves to them for short periods of time often. But as they get older, it changes. They got other things going on. They're not interested in lots of little times, but they do want some prolonged times. They want you available. When our girls were in high school, they'd always ask if we were going to go to the basketball or football games with them. And we always got kind of amused at it because, if possible, we would try to work it and set it in our schedule so we could do it. And so we say, "Hey, okay, we're going to go. You going to go with us?" "Well, no, we're going to go over with our friends." "Oh, well, you going to meet us at the game?" "Yeah, we'll meet you there." "Are you going to sit with us?" "Well, no, we're going to sit with our friends." We used to try to figure out why it was they wanted us to go to the games, sit by ourselves, but they did. But you know where they were at halftime with their friends, don't you? Up with us. Say, "Hey, Mom, why don't you meet this new friend I have?" And we saw between 10 and 12 of their friends become Christians their last 2 years of high school. And I think it was just because we were willing to be with them and be what they wanted. Give ourselves to them on their terms, not ours. And scripturally, we have some good examples of this. I'll just give you the one reference here, and you can look it up later. But 2 Timothy 3, 10 through 17. And the Apostle Paul begins this by saying, "You know, you have fully known my doctrine, my manner of life," and goes on to other things. But I thought that's very significant in writing to him. He says, "You've fully known my manner of life." He shared his life with Timothy. And then it goes on and says, "Now, Timothy, I know that from your grandmother and your mother, from Lois and Eunice, that you've been taught the Scriptures." You know, they obviously spent time with Timothy. There was a good love relationship between them. And so that's what it talks about in 2 Timothy there. And then Deuteronomy 6, 5 through 7 gives us some more guidelines. It starts out in verse 4 with, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one God." And then verse 5 says, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul, all your strength." That which we call the first and greatest commandment. And immediately after that, God says, "You know, these words which I command you shall be in your heart. You'll get to know my word. Let them be a part of your being. And thou shalt teach them diligently unto your children. You shall talk of them when you are in the house, when you lie down, when you rise up, when you walk by the way." Yeah, that's very significant. Those are all the avenues of life he's talking about. Your children are with you. You've got that kind of a camaraderie that you're together and doing things together. And in that you're sharing, God's dealing with you and God's word. Vital. Spending time with your children. I'd like to just to mention in this regard the place of family devotions. Again, we need to recognize that each of us are individual in our own aspects and our own lives because our situations are all different. But we have to find that thing which fits our circumstances and our situation and adapt it to that. You know, when your kids are little, the little saying is, you know, little kids, little devotions. And short kids, short devotions. As you get older, then you have to adapt it to their time schedule and the things that are really going to relate to them. In the early days, it may be more of your sharing, but as it gets older, it needs to be more give and take. But you try to make the devotions not something that you do here, but as a part of your whole life of sharing. And that's what Deuteronomy 6 is talking about. But devotions, this sharing of your love for the Lord and for each other and the Word of God, is just a part of everyday life because you love the Lord. You love His Word. And you just love to share it with each other. And find those things which work for you and adapt them to the changing eras of your children as they grow up and the time demands. And then, I started to give to Joyce, though she was next, but I'm still on. And in that, we also have to recognize that there's an establishing with our children of boundaries. As we work with our children, develop them along the stages of life, they have to have guidelines, boundary, and authority. All of life exists within boundaries. We know that. Sometimes we learn it the hard way. Sometimes our children may have to learn it the hard way. But they have to learn that boundaries do exist. Now, the best way to do that is by our sharing how we are under authority. Your Romans 13 tells us that we're to be under the civic authority. We're to obey the laws. Several years ago, I had the privilege of teaching the counselor training classes and handling the counseling for a evangelistic crusade up in near Seattle. And I'll never forget a story that the evangelist told one day. He was talking about parental responsibility. He said he used to, in one crusade, he'd gone back several times to this one church. And, well, it really wasn't a crusade. He'd go to this church and speak and got to know several of the families and knew this one family quite well. And he'd go to their home for dinner whenever he was there. And they had a couple of children. And one time during dinner, they had gotten to talking and the hour got late and they really were almost late for church. And this fellow was to be the speaker. And so they took off, and the father came up and kind of hesitated, didn't even hesitate, but kind of slowed down a little for a stop sign and said, "Hey, son, you see any cops around?" And took on off to the stop sign. And they got down about a half a block and heard the siren. The dad said, "Hang on, we'll get rid of him." And boy, he stepped on it and zipped around a couple blocks and up a alley and pulled into a driveway and turned off the lights. And the policeman went by and said, "Well, we got rid of him." And then he went on to church. And this guy who was doing the speaking could hardly believe it, but he didn't quite know what to do. And about 3 years later, he came back, the first time he had been back. And he got back and didn't notice this family in the congregation. Said, "Hey, where's this particular family?" He said, "Well, this guy's very bitter against God, and he just won't come to church or have anything to do with God or church or anything at all anymore." And, "Well, what happened?" He said, "Well, his son one day was in an automobile accident and was killed. And he blames God for it." "Well, what happened?" He said, "Well, the son had gone through a red light and the police went after him and he tried to get away from him and he crashed." So this fellow, this evangelist said, "I went out to their home. And I talked to the fellow and said, I understand you're bitter toward God." The guy said, "Yeah, God took the life of my son." This fellow said, "I had to tell him the way it was." I said, "No, he didn't. I was with you when you flaunted authority. When you evaded the police, when you'd broken the law, and you had your son help you do that, he learned that from you, and was a result of that he was killed. You're to blame." And then the father broke down and cried and made things right with God. But how many times have we done that? How many times do we break the laws? How many times do we complain about our job at work and yell about them and the boss and what he makes you to do? Or how many times do we reject authority? You see, our children are going to be like we are. We do reproduce after our own kind. And that first teaching of authority comes from our example. And as we share with them, and I've had to go to my kids and apologize, our kids, and apologize. One day, our oldest daughter had just gotten her driver's license. She was had passed that learning stage, got her driver's license. We were driving down one of the freeways, and she got very impatient, the person ahead of her, and said, "Why is such and such go faster or move over in her own lane?" It was very impatient. And I said, "Linda, you shouldn't be that way." And then I realized where she'd gotten it. So I apologized. I said, "Linda, I'm the one who taught you that, because I get very impatient when I drive. And I'm sorry. Will you forgive me?" Well, actually, she does a better job of driving now than I do. She's far more patient. She's learning better than I am. But God still works on me. It's one of the reasons he has to live in Pasadena, where all those little old ladies live. But anyhow, they don't live there. They drive there. But we have to establish responsibility to authority in the establishing of boundaries. And so Ecclesiastes 12:1, it says, remember thy creator in the days of thy youth. We've got to start teaching these things when the children are young. And so we need to let them know what is expected and stick with it. When you establish your guidelines, you together talk about what you want in your family, what you want your children to do and not to do. As you talk these over, then you stick with it. That way you never worry about, I wonder what the other person said. You know what the guidelines are. Because we, your parents, know that children will play parents against each other. either come up and say, hey, can I do such and such? Oh, yeah, sounds like a pretty good idea. Go ahead. And then your mate comes up and says, hey, how come you told them they could do that? I just told them they couldn't. Oh. But if you've established guidelines of authority and responsibility and what's what, you can avoid that. In our particular family, why? Anything that had to do with where the children went, as far as around the neighborhood or inviting people over for meals, that's Joyce's area of responsibility. So if the kids would come and say, I'd like to have such and such over, or can this person come and eat with us or whatever, say, talk to your mother. That's her area. If they wanted to use the car, then they came to me, because I had to know where the cars were. And so they come to the mother and say, can we use the car? Sorry, you have to talk to your father. So we establish those guidelines and do it. Now, it is important, by the way, in this realm of directing your children that Ephesians 6:4 comes in play. You don't provoke your children to wrath. As they grow, you start learning how to adjust to their growing sphere of life. And in that, sometimes you may make wrong decisions. And in establishing boundaries, you may have made mistakes. And if you do, or have, go to your children. Admit it. Say, you know, we want the best for you. And establishing these guidelines, we've done always for your best. Now, this one, apparently as we look back, we've been wrong, and we want to apologize. Will you forgive us? You know, if kids don't learn from us how to ask for forgiveness, how are they going to learn how to go to God and do the same thing? There was a professor at the University of California, Davis, who did a 9-year study on young people who seemed to have an adequate self-image and to be able to really adjust well to life and had good self-esteem. And as he did this study, he found out that those young people who were the most mature, who were able to make the best decisions and were really developing in maturity and had a good image of themselves, were those whose parents had given them very clear and often strict guidelines of conduct. And with these children, they not only did not reject their parents, they loved their parents because they felt that these were demonstrations of love toward them.
I think we forgot to tell you in the beginning, it would help you to know where we're at, that we're going to be giving you 8 of these, and you should be on 4 now. Does that work out right? Okay. To encourage your child, to spend time with him, establish boundaries and authority. The fourth one, to forgive and forget. We might be more truthful to say forgive and put away, not bring out again, if you cannot forget. The whole concept of keeping the slate clean, keeping the slate clean. As Christians, we sometimes find it hard to accept and believe and rejoice in the forgiveness of God. And often, that inability to accept our own forgiveness in the sight of God can hearken clear back to parents who always made us feel guilty, never quite seemed to measure up to what our parents wanted, and if we blew it, it was called up on every occasion of another thing that we had done. It's a terrible thing to live under condemnation, is it not? And reconciliation has to be the name of the game for a family. To learn to live together with open, transparent relationships. That's the way God is with us. It cost him a tremendous price, his only son, to buy for us reconciliation and to bring us in right relationship with him. And if God so loved us and could forgive us, we surely ought to follow that pattern in learning to forgive our children, forgive one another. Matthew 5:23-24 talks about the importance of going to one who might have a fault against you and get reconciled, get things squared away. And 1 John 1:9, how many times have you come to the Father and said, oh, thank you, Lord, for that promise, that when I confess my sin, name it by name, that you will forgive me. And then the marvelous promise in Psalm 103 that our sin can be as put as far away from us as the east is from the west. So don't be afraid to tell your children that you forgive them. And as Elvin has suggested in this whole thing of establishing boundaries, they learn by what they see. And as we come to them and ask forgiveness, they will learn how to do that with others, with us. And there's a marvelous principle. Luke 14:11 says that everyone who exalts himself shall be humbled, but he who humbles himself shall be exalted. We've found a recent example of that. We had a day that we had told Lance could be his whole day. Anything he wanted to do. Daddy was home, and I think it started after he got home from school in the afternoon. That was Lance's afternoon. Whatever you want to do, sweetheart, that's yours. So he laid out a little thing. He had to get some new shoes, and he wanted to look, just look at, mind you, football shoulder pads. He was just barely 7, but he wanted to look at them. And could we go to the sports store? We're going to walk downtown and then do all of these things together. So we decided to do that. But on the way, it was more logical to go in a different sequence than the one he had patterned out. He had a zigzag that would be going back and forth. And so Elvin tried to tell him, "Now, son, let's don't do it that way. Let's go here and here and here. They're all right in a row." "Well, Daddy, I'd really rather go here and here and here." So there was a little argument, and this little thing, we ended up, and Lancey kind of cried, but we went here, here, and here. That evening, after we'd had dinner, we talked about the next thing that was on the agenda, which was buying an ice cream cone. And so we said, "Let's go get the ice cream. And by the way, son, on the way, we need to mail a letter. Let's go to the post office, drop the letter in, go get the ice cream." Lance said, "Well, let's go get the ice cream first and then go put the letter in the mailbox." Now, that's marvelous reasoning for a 7-year-old. It was the wrong way, the wrong direction. It took longer. And he began to cry. I began to fuss at him and tell him how unreasonable it was that Daddy couldn't just put the letter in the mailbox and then go get the ice cream. It wouldn't take that long. He ended up in tears. I'd spanked him. Elvin left the house with the letter. Has anybody had this kind of a day or evening? Lance popped into the tub, horribly humiliated, and I thought, you know, something's wrong here the whole day. Elvin came back. Oh, thank God for what he did. He came into us in the bathroom and he said, "Son, I want to ask your forgiveness. This was to be your day. Not at my convenience, your day. And I want you to know I was wrong. You get your pajamas on, son, and let's get your ice cream. And would you please forgive me?" Do you know that little guy melted in his daddy's arms? I cried. He cried. Dad scooped us all up. We left the ring around the bathtub and went to the ice cream, 31 flavors, and got him a double dip or something. And you know, he still remembers that. Remember, Dad, remember that time you did that thing wrong?
He hasn't learned how to forget yet.
That's such a key. And you know, Lance finds it rather easy, I think, for a little guy to come to us and say, "I'm sorry, I was wrong. Will you forgive me?" Now, sometimes it's blurted out awfully fast. But he's a man in small, and it's a little difficult. That has nothing to do with it, does it? James 1:5 says, "If we lack wisdom, we can ask of God, who gives to all men liberally and upbraideth or reproacheth not." Are you the kind of parent that when your kid comes to you and they say, "Hey, can I do such and such?" You say, "Yes, but remember what you did last time and how you fell down and you skinned this and you ruined that." Ought we not be like our Father in heaven and learn to give wisdom without reproaching? Oh, what a key that can be. Children and adults need to know that they're forgiven. Our daughter, who's still home, has a marvelous ability to sense in her own heart and life from her time with the Lord in the morning areas that she senses she needs forgiveness in. And we've appreciated that so much in her. And we find it easier in our home relationship because of this one thing in keeping short accounts. Punishment, great. A child, if a fair punishment has to be administered, doesn't seem to mind it. They know they've been wrong. But if after the punishment has been administrated, then we can say, all right, son, it's all over and done with. They can let the air be clear and forget it. It's a marvelous thing to know in this, too, that you're teaching the husband of your daughter-in-law how to ask forgiveness. Or you may be teaching the wife of your son-in-law how to keep short accounts. By what you're doing in your home right now, you can save a lot of arguments for them, and they'll thank you down the line. Number five, express your love verbally. How many people we talk to who say, well, I know my folks must have loved me, but they sure never told me. Or I was raised in a home where nobody ever said, hey, I love you, or gave you a squeeze, or whatever. And when a child discovers that he's an object of deep interest and that there's pride in him, and he begins to feel like he's a person of some worth, a child needs to develop like a sun shining down on a flower, the warmth of love in a home. You need to love spontaneously with the things we've talked about in the marriage relationship, with a look or a squeeze or a pat. Our little guy comes sailing by, and he knows he never can lift a finger to his mother. Never. But he'll come by, and he'll swap me one. He's probably seen his daddy do it. And say, love, Pat, Mom. Now, I know there are times when he's not very happy with me. I have a sneaking hunch he gets a little something out there. But there are so many ways you can do this. Our children, with all three of them, it's been a great joy to them. We go over baby pictures. And we talk about when they were babies. This is as a little child. We talk about the day they were born, all the events, and how proud we were and what Daddy did. I've known parents who are parents of adopted children who do the same kind of thing, explaining about when they went to get them and how they felt and the joy that was there. The child just grows and thrives under this kind of thing. The kind of love that 1 Corinthians 13 talks about, love in action, love that really does act, that expresses respect and concern for the child. And back again to our Father, Jeremiah 31:3, who says, I've loved you with an everlasting love. That's pretty loved. As the Father's loved me, so I love you, Jesus said in John 17. 1 John 4:19 says, we love him because he first loved us. And if you want your children to be loving, well-adjusted, happy, secure youngsters, it starts with love. People love because they are loved from infancy to adulthood. And you can do it with older children by cards, by notes, by all kinds of ways. One thing that has been very key, passed on to us when our children were young, and it's been a great help, is that fathers need to express physical love to their daughters all through their growing up years so that they have a sense of being loved by a man, so they don't have to go elsewhere and look for that. And moms can create the climate of love in the home, all that can be involved.
About 2.5 years ago, I had the privilege of having a fellow come to know Christ in one of our couple's Bible studies who come from what we call the hippie background. And he had checked in almost all the religions of the world and was on his second marriage and was on drugs at this particular time, although I wasn't aware of it. And when he came to the studies, he'd come and he'd say, well, I don't think I'll ever become a Christian, and I'm not sure how true the Bible is, other than I do know that where psychologists have proven that a principle of life is true because it stood the test of time, that principle is in the Bible. Well, within 6 months, this fellow had become a Christian, he and his wife, and we've seen 70, 80 people become Christians as a result of that, and made them out of the drug culture. In fact, I didn't know until about 8 months ago that the first 3 or 4 studies we had in this guy's home with 16 young people, that they'd have pot parties before I got there. But, you know, they all got converted. I think all except 3 of them were converted, and that changed things. But the principle there has to do with this next area, and that's your communication with your child. The world's principles, proverbs, are not always true. The Bible's are.
The world says a child should be seen, not heard. That's not true. That is false. Your children need to be heard. There needs to be two-way communication. They need to know that they're a person, that they have a place. Now, as they grow older, of course, they need to learn respect of other people and that type of thing. But your child needs to be able to share his own feelings, his own thoughts, or he's going to learn to repress them. And you want to get that communication going. And I've been, we've even seen it in our home where we'll have maybe adults having young people live with us, and often many adults over. We might end up with 10 or 12 adults and our little boy. And we try to keep watch on him, and he may sit there for a while, and there may be six conversations going on. And finally, you sit there, and he puts his hands over his ears. And so about that time, we stop everybody. Say, hey, Lance, you haven't said anything for a while. Why don't you tell us what you did yesterday? Anything to draw him in so he knows he's a person and he's a part. We have to do that. Being involved in the ministry in the level we are, we're often involved in counseling sessions. My door is never closed to Lance. Maybe closed, but it's open to him. It's open to any of our children. There's never a time when they can't come to me. Let me ask you a question. Is there ever a time when you can't approach God? No. Now, granted, again, our children need to learn as they grow older that there are priorities, there are considerations of other people. But as a little child, they don't understand that. All they know is that here's my dad or here's my mom, and I want to tell them something, and they should have that privilege. It usually won't take much time to be and share, and then they're off happily. But they've been with you. They're sharing their life with you. So this two-way communication of you with your child is vital. And it's interesting in Matthew 19:14 that the apostles really got uptight because these kids, these little children, want to come and talk to Jesus. Oh, sorry. No, he's got to heal these people over here. And he's got to do this miracle. He's got to do this great teaching. He said, hey. You know, let the little children come unto me. Don't forbid them. That's really the way where the kingdom of heaven is, being like a little child, to have access to the Father. So we need to establish that two-way communication, to let the children talk. Again, I think mothers are far better at this type of a thing, to get the kids to express their feelings than perhaps we as fathers, or at least I am. You know, I can relate to Lance on certain levels, and we talk about the Dodgers. You call up tonight and say, where's Hank Aaron in the home run derby? And he'll tell you. Unless he got one today, he's 30 to go, you know. He knows that. But he also knows some things about from the Bible. But sometimes his feelings, you're like, how does he feel about school? I don't often think about asking him those kind of questions, but I'm working on it. Find out what he likes. And I've gotten some real surprises. I found out he liked some subjects that I didn't think he liked. Didn't care for some that I thought he was really crazy about. You know, we need to establish that kind of way, that two-way communication. That's point number six. Point number seven is to give responsibilities. We talked earlier today about in Jerry White's Mary session, I'm sure she covered as Jerry did, that if you're going to accomplish anything, you have to make a committal in it. You have to build it into your schedule and make sure that it's done. Most of us kind of have a natural tendency to not do things. We call it laziness. I am ultra lazy. I happen to be very blessed by God in that He also gave me kind of a thing that I'm not content unless things that have to be done are done. So here I have these two natures, just laziness and getting things done. And fortunately, the getting things done wins because I just can't stand to see them undone. Otherwise, I'd just loaf all the time, you know. But we have this, and it's kind of built in. Well, we have to help our children learn to develop. And so they have to be given responsibilities. In fact, most children who tend to grow up sexually perverted, it happens because within the family, often the mother won't allow them to become independent. She does everything for them and controls their life, and they get a false point of view, which goes and starts affecting many other areas of their lives. We've got to teach our children responsibility. Give them jobs. Make sure they do them. And you've got to be inventive and ingenious enough to figure out how you do it. In Lance's room, we have a little schedule. When he gets up in the morning, these are the things that he does. You know, he brushes his teeth. He makes his bed. He empties all the waste baskets. You know, practices piano lessons. And that's right on the list. And he does those. And if Joyce doesn't check him up, which he does, and sometimes along with her, I do too. I say, hey, Lance, so did you get the checklist done this morning? So he knows I'm concerned about him. You know, I'm interested in what he's doing. I'm interested in his accomplishments. And he's getting a pride in doing things and doing them well. We have a little back house, a little cabin deal that was given to us and by some neighbors when they moved. And he keeps all of his play gear in there, his basketball and baseballs and footballs and bats and a few cars and things. But it's very interesting. I put a shelf in there. He said, Lance, that's yours. And he puts everything in there very meticulously and really carefully. And one day I went out, was all messed up, and I said, hey, what happened? He said, oh, you know, those kids came over to play, and they messed everything up, and now I got to put it back together. Well, he did, because it's his area, and he knows that. And so we have to give our children guidelines. Lamentations 3:27 says it's good for a man to bear the yoke in his youth. Your life is not permissive. Life is not easy. Life is hard. Those of us who have been around a few years know that. And it's only the person that's learned to accept responsibilities and handle them and meet these things as they come along that can meet life and succeed. And so we need to give our children and take them as they grow and increase that area of responsibility and with it the area of privilege. As they become older, the areas of where they can make decisions should increase. I think in this area of responsibility, we also need to teach our children wise use of money. Sit down and teach them why it's important to give to the Lord. Why it's important to lay some aside in a savings account. You know, where they spend what they have and why they can't have some things. And how they can utilize this money to save and get maybe something they wanted. Or Mother's Day comes up and, hey Lance, what are you going to buy Mother? Well, I don't have any money. Well, remember when we talked about saving for important days so you could buy something? You know, well, he contributes, but he's got to learn that he, before long, as he gets older, carries that whole brunt himself to learn to become financially independent. So we have to do this. Overindulgence can do nothing but cause problems. Generally speaking, the reason many people do not discipline their children, give them responsibilities, give them guidelines, is they say, well, I'm afraid if I do this, my child won't love me. What they're afraid of is themselves. You know, they're not afraid of the child. They're afraid of for themselves. And they're not willing to put themselves on the line to risk that love for the sake of the child. They love themselves too much. And the parent who does that will always thwart the child. Because when you look to what you're going to get out of it rather than what the child gets out of it, the child suffers. And the important thing to remember is being a parent, is not a popularity contest. Your children will not always think that you're the world's greatest when you make them hold the line. But I will tell you this, that if you do that lovingly, give them the guidance, that in the end your children will rise up and call you blessed.
We've decided that you're neither as poor a parent as your kids might think you are in the teens when they're just that first flush of independence, nor as good as they think you are when they first left home and started their own home. Our daughter getting away, it's amazing how much we learned in the first 6 months she got after she was married. And she felt that some of the things we had said made sense to her in her own new life, her own role. The last one is the importance of cooperating with the personality and maturity that you find in each of your children. That is, you avoid comparing that child with any other child in the family or with anybody else's family. They are not the other person, they are themselves. And we can frustrate our children terribly by trying to form them to a mold that we think they should, in which we think they should fit, rather than letting them be uniquely individually themselves. We have to be careful not to let our ego and our pride and our expectations for them get in the way. Elvin has often said that he doesn't want our son to end up being warped somewhere because Daddy likes sports. So he has a side of music that we're working on so he doesn't end up all one lopsided child. And he happens to enjoy sports. But you have to be careful. And some of the things that we've learned is we have our two older girls off and gone are things that we can learn in hindsight that are helpful. The scriptures teach us that favoritism is just deadly. And if you want to see some scriptural examples of that, you can see Joseph. His brothers hated him. He was his dad's favorite. He had the coat of many colors. And Isaac and Esau, bitter, bitter enemies. Rebekah, who preferred Jacob and the problems that it caused. And some children will just not fit a mold of college, of some profession you might have planned for them. Some are artistic. And so our great need is to find out, help that child to find out their area of success and help build them in it so they can be the kind of person they should be. To recognize that God has a plan for each life. You know, God does not play favorites. Acts 10:34 said, I perceive, Paul said, that God shows no partiality. Romans 2:11, for God shows no partiality. Ephesians 6:9, there's no partiality with him. James puts it very bluntly, if you show partiality, you commit sin. There are not second-class people with God. There aren't second-class occupations. After all, the Lord Jesus was a carpenter, a humble man. And people in his town said, isn't this Joseph, the carpenter's son? And if you want a lovely illustration of that, you can see the Lord as he met with his disciples. Can you imagine two people more diverse than James the zealot and Matthew the tax collector? Matthew, who was a traitor to all that the Jewish people stood for by collecting taxes for Rome. And Simon, who had pledged himself as a zealot to kill any tax collector he could if he could knife him without anybody knowing it, in the same band of men. Can you imagine Peter, loud, always having an answer, always spouting off about something, with dear John, even though he was the son of thunder, this man of love? So the diversity of the men around the Lord Jesus. So we need to find in our children that which they seem to be able to do and encourage them in it, individually, uniquely finding that they're their own people, so that when they grow up, they're not going to feel that you poured them into something that they really never were fitted for.
Children were intended to be a delight. And yet, you look at our world today, and most parents are totally frustrated by the life, the attitude, the actions of their children. But the responsibility lays with us. We're the ones who have failed. Even we in the Christian world have failed. Because we have failed, often to set the example, to give them the training, to give the training, to share with others that they can know. So we have to bear that responsibility. Well, how do we go about putting some of these things in to our lives and the lives of our children? First of all, to realize the effect that you as an individual in your life will have on your child's life. You know why most children don't memorize Scripture? Because their parents don't memorize Scripture. In fact, it's very interesting. You often go to a Sunday school graduation service, and a class will come up, and the teacher will say, now, our class has been memorizing 1 Corinthians 13. So we're going to quote it for you now. Okay, girls, all together now, let's quote 1 Corinthians 13. Just a minute. And the teacher turns to her Bible to look at it while the kids quote it. Or we wonder why our children are children of prayer. But how often have they found you on your knees?
How often have they gotten up in the morning and gone in and found you poring over the Word or praying over the Word? Or how often have they heard you share with someone else what Jesus Christ means to you? Or have you had someone in your home and the kids go to bed and you say, hey kids, you know, these people don't know Jesus and they really need Him. So would you help us? Would you pray, you know, while you're here in bed and pray that they really know what Jesus can do for them? And then to see their eyes in the morning when they get up and the first thing is, hey, did they ask Jesus in their heart, you know, to cooperate together in the gospel? Have your kids done that? Have they seen you apologize to your mate and say, hey, remember a while ago when I talked back to you about that thing? That was bad. I was wrong. Would you forgive me? Have they seen you do that? They're going to learn from you. They're going to learn from you. So the first thing is to recognize the needs in your own life and then do something about it. And the same thing that you need to observe and practice together, the guidelines you want for your children. Talk about that. What do you really want? And let me just add a word in this particular realm is major on the majors, not on the minors. You know, it's not nearly as important that your child pick up the toys in this room as it is that they tell the truth. You know, they've got to learn that lying lips are an abomination to the Lord, but they that deal truly are His delight. And that nobody likes a liar. Nobody wants to be a friend to a liar. And, you know, they should learn somebody to pick up their toys, but that's not a major. You know, you can bypass some of those things. But lying, stealing, those type of things, that's what you want to major on. And talk over together how you're going to do it. Establish your guidelines together. And then don't exceed your area of responsibility as a husband or wife. And in that, you don't countermand the instructions or orders of the other. Even if it did supersede what you'd already talked about. Now, you may change it. God holds the husband responsible for all that goes on in the family. And if the husband disagrees with a decision his wife has made, he can change it, but he doesn't change it before the children. He changes in private consultation with his wife where they talk about why the decision was made. And if it was still the wrong decision, then the wife changes it. The mother changes it to the children, not the father. So the children never see one countermand the other. They realize that you're working together, that you two are literally one. So you have to do that. Then you commit yourself to the Lord. You cannot do it on your own. No way. And day by day, you seek the Lord's training. You seek His guidance. As He teaches you things, you can teach the children. Day by day, He'll give you the power to make the right decisions. He'll give you the wisdom, as Joyce mentioned in James 1:5. So these are some of the practical hows. And then just as a final concluding remark, remember that when you're training your children, you're also training the parents of your grandchildren.